As the globe battles COVID-19, Puerto Rico is also battling the epidemic of violence against women.
After Hurricane Maria, there was no power, no clean water, no access to employment, healthcare, and all of those factors can contribute to make the home a much more unsafe environment for victims of intimate partner violence.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 1st, we take a look at the high rates of intimate partner violence in Puerto Rico. Also, how contact tracing to prevent the spread of COVID-19 may not be going as well as experts hoped. And we round out the show with Afro-Latino artist Sean Leonardo on the challenges he faces when depicting high-profile incidents of police violence.
People are sensitive to the ways in which white institutions have paraded Black trauma.
But first, we take a look at the pressure mounting on Facebook to regulate hate speech on its platform.
I don't think that Facebook or internet platforms in general should be arbiters of truth. I think that's a kind of a dangerous line to get down to in terms of deciding what is true and what isn't.
That's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg speaking with CNBC in May. Since the 2016 election, many have wanted Facebook to do more to stop posts that incite violence and spread misinformation. But Zuckerberg continued to present Facebook as a bastion of free speech until last week, when the company announced it would begin, quote, prohibiting a wider category of hateful content in ads and will remove content if that content leads to violence or deprives people of their right to vote. Pressure began mounting for Facebook in May to take action after President Trump posted the racist saying, quote, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, on Twitter and Facebook in response to the nationwide uprising for racial justice. Twitter hid the tweet. Facebook did nothing. And now a campaign called Stop Hate for Profit, created by a group of national civil rights organizations, is pressuring Zuckerberg by coordinating advertising boycotts. Ad sales make up the vast majority of Facebook's revenue. Nearly 100 brands, including Unilever and Coca-Cola, have announced a temporary stop to their advertising campaigns on Facebook. As a result, Facebook shares fell nearly 8% last Friday, the same day Facebook announced a change to its policies. Politics, hate speech, misinformation, and social media. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. With us now is Jade Magnus Oganaki, the Deputy Senior Campaign Director for Color of Change, and Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post's Silicon Valley correspondent. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jade, let's start with you. Tell us about how the Stop Hate for Profit campaign emerged.
Yeah, well, you know, we are in a watershed moment for racial justice around the country, you know, since the protests in Minneapolis have spread to all 50 states. And, you know, are happening internationally as well. You know, Black organizers and movement have pushed the culture to acknowledge the fact that Black people are killed in police and vigilante killings. And for the first time, we're actually seeing corporations feel pressure to affirm that Black Lives Matter or to speak out against police and vigilante killings of Black people. And so, you know, folks all over the country are looking for these corporations to put their money where their mouth is, and that's really where Facebook comes in. Facebook has long been a violator of human rights and civil rights on the platform. So many Black organizations and organizers have been harmed on Facebook with the lack of content moderation, with the rampant disinformation that's constantly pushed on the platform. And corporations are responding to Color of Change's call to stop using the platform for the month of July. Color of Change has been pushing Facebook for the past 5 years to address the lack of content moderation, the lack of civil rights infrastructure, the push of disinformation all over the platform, and corporations can no longer sit by and, you know, pump billions into Facebook while it's such a, you know, a cesspool for all of these sorts of horrible interactions.
Elizabeth, speaking to that point, I mean, the Facebook ad revenue is largely the majority of its revenue right now. Can you give us a sense of what effect you think this temporary boycott is actually going to have on their overall digital ad revenue?
Well, I know that they're absolutely scrambling to, you know, having calls daily or every other day with advertisers, that they're scrambling to stop the bleeding. And it will be interesting to see how much metal the advertisers have, because people have commented that, and this isn't to undermine the campaign in any way, but people have commented that because people are there, it's a very slow shopping season. We're in the middle of a pandemic, so advertisers had already been pulling back. So it was much more, it was a convenient or it was an opportune moment for them to take a stand on their values and or to take a stand about values when they were being called to do so. So what I'm interested in seeing is how long they'll do that, because how long they'll be able to keep the pressure, because Facebook has very, very, very deep pockets. And it's one of the wealthiest companies in history.
And those deep pockets, Elizabeth, go beyond ad dollars?
No, they're 99.9, more than 99% of their revenue is from digital advertising. But we're talking about a month, and this is a very, very wealthy company that could ride out a month.
Jade, a lot of companies, as you mentioned, some big ones, including Unilever, have pledged not to advertise on Facebook, but they're still posting on Facebook and Instagram. Why not an entire boycott of the platform?
Yeah, you know, we see companies like Coca-Cola, Starbucks, Adidas, Verizon, you know, have joined in the pause for the month of July. And, you know, even a company like Unilever has, you know, made a commitment to not use Facebook ads through the end of the year. We didn't ask people to stop posting on Facebook. You know, we really wanted to hit Facebook with ad revenue. We really wanted to, you know, hit them in the pockets and, you know, have corporations be held accountable for the ways that they interact with Facebook. And so we're really excited to see how this plays out through the month of July and beyond. You know, this today marks the beginning of the Stop Hate for Profit pause for the month of July. And, you know, we're really we're seeing how corporations are taking a stand. It's really exciting. And we're sure more companies are going to join in on, you know, continuing the pause through the end of the year. While Facebook definitely has deep pockets, they're scrambling, as Elizabeth noted. It proves that they're very nervous about the way that this appears to the public and the way that this is, you know, hitting their bank account.
Elizabeth, I want to talk about how this appears to the public. I mean, this is not the first time, to both of your points, that Facebook has come under pressure to somehow moderate what's on its platform. And we can get into the specifics of whether Facebook sees themselves as a publisher or as a platform. But you've been reporting that this struggle goes back years. And I want to play a clip for you from last November. Some of our listeners may remember that Zuckerberg was testifying before the House, and Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked him about fact-checking, specifically with political ads on Facebook. And here's what he had to say.
I think lying is bad. And I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being, in our position, the right thing to do to prevent your constituents or people in an election from seeing that you had lied.
Elizabeth, I have to listen to that clip a couple of times. Can you help me understand what Zuckerberg was trying to say there about political advertising?
Sure. I mean, he's saying, and it goes beyond political advertising, he's kind of repeating a trope that he's actually repeated a long time and is a very common trope in Silicon Valley. It used to be uttered by Twitter, which prior to all this was known internally as the free speech wing of the free speech party. Now Zuckerberg is that. He's saying that we'll let people lie because things that AOC and other leaders say have huge public interest. And if we let them lie, then people will know who they are. People will make the judgment call for themselves. Essentially, it's that classic argument that counter speech is the best check on speech, or sunlight is the best disinfectant. That's what he's saying.
So, Jade, we know that we announced at the very top here that Facebook made some changes. And Elizabeth, I'd like you to explain exactly what some of those changes were. But is Color of Change satisfied with where Facebook is right now, Jade? Or are there more changes that you are expecting to see from Facebook?
Absolutely not. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook have made these sort of like piecemeal promises, commitments over the course of the 5 years that we've been campaigning against Facebook. You know, the quote unquote changes that he laid out on Friday, like labeling newsworthy content or still refusing to fact check politicians' claims, but, you know, putting labels on certain articles. It just proves that Facebook is nervous about the way that the public is perceiving them, about the way corporations are perceiving them. They're trying to release a list of tiny measures that will appease corporations and the public, when the truth of the matter is that even more corporations dropped out after he announced those quote unquote changes on Friday. Nothing but a permanent civil rights infrastructure with a C-suite level executive whose job is to investigate and assess the product of Facebook and how it enables harm and discrimination and bias is going to be a big enough change for Color of Change and the rest of the members of our coalition. These small tweaks are totally irrelevant in the large scheme of things.
Elizabeth, what's being debated here largely is the difference between free speech versus hate speech. And I'd love for you to explain what Facebook's legal responsibility is to regulate hate speech on its platform. There's something called Section 230, correct?
Sure. Well, in the United States, they have no legal responsibility to do that. I want to echo Jade, though, and say that this is a company that, in my history of covering them 7 years, they are very responsive to public pressure. So I wouldn't be surprised if they take more steps, and they take a number of the steps that the campaign is asking. But do I think they're going to start regulating speech in a drawing a line, for example, around lies and fact checking around politicians? They may make some changes on the margins, but it's very, very hard for Zuckerberg to make a major change there, as far as just taking back, saying we're not going to allow, you're asking them essentially to remove posts by a sitting president. And he has gone so hard and said he won't do that. And he really sees himself as a person who needs to make decisions that will allow Facebook to survive long term.
But Elizabeth, let me read you something here from his points, because Zuckerberg wrote on his Facebook post, he says, quote, "Even if a politician or a government says it, if we determine that content may lead to violence or deprive people of their right to vote, we will take that content down. And there are no exceptions for politicians in any of the policies he announced on Friday." Your response to that? Does that not cover what we're talking about?
Well, yes, and that is new. He's drawing two carve-outs. He's saying if political speech leads to violence, then we'll take it down. If it suppresses voting, we'll take it down. That is new for him to say it so clearly. Those are two small carve-outs. But we also know, and they're significant, but we also know that even President Trump's racially tinged tweet, the racially divisive tweet of when the shooting starts, he said that wouldn't have even applied. They didn't even see that as an incitement to violence, which is what millions of people did see as an incitement to violence. So I think there's going to be a lot of calls they make where they're going to say, oh yeah, we will remove something as an incitement to violence, but we don't really think that comes to the line. So you also have to judge what is what. You asked about regulation. Yeah, there's no legal responsibility in the United States for them to do anything around hate speech. In other countries, there is, actually. And so it's interesting to look at what they're doing in Europe, where there actually are stronger regulations on how they police speech. And guess what? They're surviving and they're doing it.
I was sort of getting at Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, right? Which basically says that internet service providers like Twitter, Facebook, Craigslist cannot be treated as publishers. And so they're not liable for the content that's produced by others. That's according to that 1996 act. Now, the president recently made an executive order regarding Section 230. Can you tell us what he did there and what the effect of that change will be?
Well, many people think that that change does not have much legal standing, that it wouldn't stand up in court. And so it's a question of whether it was more just kind of showmanship, and especially in an election year. But what the executive order does, and there's also a separate effort underway in the Justice Department to undermine Section 230, and specifically he instructed federal agencies to look into how they could further police and enforce violations of free speech when tech companies essentially are biased. You know, conservatives have been complaining for years, really without evidence, that tech companies are biased against their content. Not only is it without evidence, some conservative and right-leaning influencers are some of the biggest users of these platforms. And as I and others have reported, they have gone out of their way, particularly Facebook, to actually appease them. And oftentimes when they make a change in the product, like changing the newsfeed, they're always looking at it and saying, will this appear biased? And then protecting conservatives so that they don't appear biased. But it hasn't gotten them much political capital, particularly in an election year. And so what happened was when Twitter labeled the tweet, when Twitter labeled a Trump tweet about mail-in ballots, the very next day the administration retaliated with this executive order. And while I don't think that the legal that the executive order is, you know, would pass muster in court from everyone I've talked to, it just kind of it crystallizes this moment where there's a lot of frustration with the immunity that tech giants have. You have these tech companies that are basically beholden to this law that's more than 20 years old at this point. It was written at a time when these companies were very small. And even the author of Section 230, Senator Ron Wyden, has said that it needs to be revisited. This law essentially was saying we need to protect these companies because they're very small. And if they're held legally responsible for everything that's said on their platforms, well, then they're going to crumble and die. But now these are the richest companies in the world. And you do have lots of different models, particularly the news media, where they do police what's on their platform. They do exercise editorial and judgment. Now, journalistic companies, including the Washington Post, were much, much smaller companies than a Facebook or a YouTube or even a Twitter. But you do say to yourself, they're subject to different legal regimes around the world, where they do a lot more policing. You know, in France, I believe, or in Europe, you know, in Germany, you can't put up a lot of, for example, Nazi symbolism. That's just illegal. And if you put it up, you're going to get in legal trouble. And they managed to take off a lot more. Same with Holocaust denialism. So I think that argument that they can't take off a lot more than they do, that it would somehow really, really hurt these companies, it's hard for me to imagine that when they do have regimes in other countries where they police a lot more speech. And though they fail a lot in that, they are able to do more, and they certainly have the wealth to do more. However, I do think that if Section 230 was eroded, it would transform these companies. And what's really fascinating is that there's this movement both on the right and the left to say, you know what, 230, it doesn't work anymore. It's been for too long, it's given too much immunity to these companies that are now so very powerful. You know, the left would like them, the right wants the companies to be held to greater account over bias. The left wants them to be held to greater account over the discrimination and racism. So from both sides of the aisle, there's this push, but they haven't been able to agree because the reasons why they want the companies to change are so very different.
That was Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Washington Post Silicon Valley correspondent, and Jade Magnus Oganaki, the deputy senior campaign director for Color of Change. For the past few years, life in Puerto Rico has been difficult. The island has been hammered by a debt crisis, Hurricane Maria, systemic corruption, and now the coronavirus pandemic. And according to a new investigation from Gen Magazine and Type Media Center, the rate of intimate partner violence has also been on the rise. In 2018, at least 23 women in Puerto Rico were killed by former or current intimate partners. That's more than twice the rate of the rest of the United States. Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez is a senior writer for Gen and an Ida B. Wells Fellow at Type Investigations, and her reporting points to systemic failures by the Puerto Rican government that have contributed to the troubling rise of violence against women and the failures to hold their killers accountable. Andrea, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tansina. Thank you for having me.
So we know the scale of the problem. We're talking about 23 women who have been killed. What were some of the factors that you found that contributed to this problem on the island?
So we saw an uptick in murders right after Hurricane Maria. And the way that advocates see this crisis is one that was directly related to the storm, right? After Hurricane Maria, there was no power, no clean water, no access to employment, healthcare, and all of those factors we know that after a natural disaster can contribute to make the home a much more unsafe environment for victims of intimate partner violence. So that's one part of it. The second part of it is the way that the government has systematically failed survivors for years and years and years. They know this has been a problem since at least 1989, when the law criminalizing domestic violence was first passed in Puerto Rico. And even then, we still have issues with how the police handles cases, with how the courts handle cases, and the government has not really seen this issue as a priority that needs to be dealt with.
Andrea, femicide is the systemic killing of women, and this has happened throughout the world. We've also seen it happening throughout Latin America. Why has it been so difficult for there to be any sort of protective measures passed in Puerto Rico? You mentioned the law against domestic violence was passed in 1989, which is still relatively late, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the holdup here? I know that there were women's groups that wanted to meet with Ricardo Rosselló before his ouster. Tell us more about that.
Well, part of it is just like Puerto Rican society at large, right? Puerto Rican society is a machista society. It's a very patriarchal, conservative society where some sectors that have outside influence in the government, like far-right conservatives and religious groups, don't view this as an issue. They don't view gender equality as an issue, and therefore they think that domestic violence is a problem of the house, of like inside the home, instead of a public health issue. And there's no political will for a lot of the lawmakers to make this a priority. They're more busy passing anti-abortion legislation or the new civil code in the island instead of hearing the claims from like advocates who have been fighting on this issue for a really long time.
And Andrea, do we know whether or not economic stressors have also added to this? Generally speaking, when people are also out of work, the high rates of unemployment on the island have sort of had a double impact with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, et cetera. Is this also a question of people being out of work and economic stressors?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely the debt crisis that the island has seen has contributed to the uptick in violence and the lethality of the violence, but also the ability of the government to respond to this crisis. Puerto Rico's finances are currently managed by a fiscal control board, and they make a ton of decisions on how the government's money is supposed to be spent, which that means is that there's been a ton of austerity measures that have impacted, for example, the police. There are fewer police officers now than there were 10 years ago, and that definitely also has an impact in their ability to do their job, combined with the things that we already talked about, like the machismo culture and just this inability of seeing domestic violence as a public health issue.
And for those who may not know, machismo culture is sexist culture, essentially.
Yes.
Andrea, can you talk to us about one person's story that really stood with you in your reporting?
Yeah, so the story that stuck out to me the most was that of Zuliani Calderon Nieves. She was a 38-year-old healthcare worker who was murdered by her ex-husband in front of her children in May of 2018. Zuliani did not seek help from the police, but she did seek a protective order that was not renewed in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. And it was just one of those cases that showed to the extent that victims may not feel like they're safe seeking help. And they may feel like people in their immediate family and in their community might not understand that there's abuse happening within within their homes behind closed doors. Her story really stuck out to me, and she's kind of like the main character throughout the investigation, also because her family has now taken the role of advocates and have really been calling for Governor Wanda Vasquez to declare a state of emergency due to the crisis of gender violence in the island.
I want to get a little bit more into what Wanda Vasquez is doing about this. But before that, we mentioned earlier that there have been women's groups on the island. In fact, before Governor Rosselló was ousted by the Puerto Rican people, there were women's groups who had been setting up shop in front of the governor's mansion to get the attention of Governor Rosselló at the time. And they were not invited to speak to the governor, from what we understand. Where do a lot of those organizations stand today, Andrea? What type of work are they trying to do under the Wanda Vasquez administration?
So they've been calling for Governor Vasquez to declare the state of emergency, which basically would release additional funds and prioritize this crisis with the utmost urgency, just like you would see with a declaration of emergency for hurricanes, for earthquakes, for the debt crisis, for the coronavirus, you name it. So the work that they've been doing has been a lot of like education, outreach to victims, and all of that, but they cannot do that work alone. So they've been calling on the government to also support them in this way, but that has not happened. In 2018 was when the wave of protests began to like get this declaration of emergency going. And this was because by November 2018, it had become increasingly clear that it was the worst year for women in Puerto Rico in recent history. Because as you said at the top of the show, 23 women got killed that year, which was more than twice the rate in the U.S. mainland.
Andrea, we know, though, that Wanda Vasquez has heard these calls. Ricardo Rosselló also heard the calls and then, as we mentioned, was ousted from his position. But Wanda Vasquez has heard the calls. This is not new. What is her response to these calls?
She declared a national alert, which basically is kind of like a watered-down version of the declaration of emergency and doesn't go as far. And through that national alert, she created a working group that's supposed to come up with a plan on how to handle domestic violence in the island. But that plan, we have not seen it yet. The working group started organizing last fall. The national alert was passed in September of 2019, but there's still no draft of the plan that has been made public. So we really do not know what that looks like. And some feminist groups that were part of the working group have since left because they say that the government has not really taken their concerns or their suggestions to heart. And they're just like, you know, pretending to be working, making suggestions such as creating an education campaign against reggaeton, the popular urban music genre, instead of looking at the systemic failures within the government.
Well, let's not forget that we are in the middle of a global pandemic. COVID-19 has affected Puerto Rico as well. We know that here in the United States, there have been many concerns because of shelter-in-place orders about increasing cases of domestic violence here in the United States and around the world. What is the situation on the island, Andrea, with the COVID-19 right now? Are people, I know that there's been a curfew that's been extended, but what is the situation on the ground?
Yeah, so for a few months, the island was in total lockdown. That has since been lifted, but there's still some restrictions. And as you mentioned, there's a curfew. Some essential workers are already going back to work. And, you know, the curfew remains mandatory. So if you are not out of your house after 10 p.m., you're probably going to get arrested. The cases have been slowly increasing in recent days, which has been a cause of concern as people kind of like retake their regular lives. And Wanda Vasquez just announced that if you are traveling to Puerto Rico, you need to take a serological coronavirus test before you're allowed into the island, or otherwise you're going to have to quarantine for 14 days.
And last but not least, the island has also declared a state of emergency because of a severe drought. 140,000 some odd folks are without running water right now. Andrea, what's the latest?
Yeah, there have been rationing water, which is something that, you know, happens pretty often during the summer because of this drought that you mentioned. So, yeah, that's been like kind of like a ongoing issue that we've seen before.
Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez is senior writer for Gen Magazine and an Ida B. Wells Fellow at Type Investigations. Thanks for joining us again, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
I try to find ways in which I can both literally and metaphorically create space within the drawings so that we can sit with them differently, even in the pain and the trauma.
New York City-based artist Sean Leonardo is known for his charcoal drawings depicting high-profile incidents of police violence against Black and brown people.
My argument is that there is something to gain from this difficult imagery that is lost in the media noise of how they are typically presented to us.
Sean is Afro-Latino, and his work feels particularly relevant following the killings of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and Rashard Brooks, images and videos of which were repeatedly shared by news outlets and on social media. But in March, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland canceled an exhibition of Sean's drawings after some local Black activists voiced their opposition to the show. A statement put out by the museum said, quote, "We encountered troubling community response that suggested at this time we were not prepared to engage with the lived experiences of pain and trauma that the work evokes." Sean was given little advance warning of the cancellation, and he told me that the museum's explanation didn't sit well with him for a few reasons.
There is an institutional failure in the ways that they intended to invite audiences, specifically Black and brown subjectivities, into a process in which we were discussing the work critically, but also with care. I don't pretend that this work is not difficult and that there is a very painful relationship to looking at these images, but I still deeply believe in what is possible. And more so, I also know and have experienced what type of nuanced, complex conversations can be elicited by the work.
And isn't that
way,
the point of work of the work,
it
though,
is
Sean?
The
work,
exactly. To use it as a jumping off point, to use it as a catalyst for conversations that would otherwise not happen. And also to expand the conversation, a conversation that is so often reduced to a news headline. And so what I will share with you is that those that have been codified by the museum as Black activist community that voice their grievances, concerns, that is fair. And while individuals have not had a physical experience with the work, I completely acknowledge how they might want to distance themselves and feel like it might cause harm.
Harm
However,
to who, Sean? Harm to who?
Well, as it's being shared, harm to local community, Black and brown communities in Cleveland. And that is what has been initially vaguely spoken about by the museum. But that has more and more has been revealed, and more individuals have gone public regarding how they felt it would have been a bad moment for the work. My point of view, however, is that if we can't hold the conversations, if art can't lead those discussions, then we will never have them. And that actually I would invite the tension. I would invite the debate because that's what's necessary about the work.
You wrote a letter this month criticizing the museum's decision, saying that it was, quote, institutional white fragility that led to an act of censorship. The museum has apologized for canceling the show, and this month their director, Jill Snyder, stepped down. Between your letter and Snyder stepping down, where do you think the museum stands right now in terms of, is it headed in the right direction, or is there still institutional white fragility, in your words, that needs to be rooted out?
Well, let me first describe what I meant by that statement. I think what is evident to me is not that the museum had no capacity to engage audiences, Black and Brown community stakeholders in this process. It's that there was no willingness to do so. And that at the first instance of potential pushback or concern, which, to be very honest, has as much to do with the museum's positionality in the community as it does my work and the content of my work, the failure of the institution was to meet that demand head on and to create space for the necessary, very difficult, intense conversations. And more so, to move beyond that, to enact any process without my voice. And that is, to me, what I shared in the statement was most hurtful. It's not necessarily that they arrived at this decision, because I could have arrived at a very similar decision as to how to host this exhibition or invite audiences in, is that I was excluded from the process entirely. And so, to directly respond to the other half of your question, time will tell. My fear is that, and this goes beyond me, this goes beyond my relationship with this museum. My fear is that in the short to long term, decisions will be made that are surface level. If there's not an internal commitment to reckoning with one's institutional whiteness, then the conversations will never be true. Then the work will never actualize deep systemic change. And that goes to the restructuring of leadership. That goes to the ways in which exhibitions are held, the conversations that are critical to audiences. That is the way in which people are welcome into the space. None of that will actually move into a place that is grounded in anti-racism unless the individuals within are willing to ask themselves some very hard question about their own white subjectivity.
Is one of those questions, Sean, also whether or not these institutions capitalized off of Black pain?
Mm-hmm. So that is a very... that's a necessary debate to have. And I think that is very much part of the pushback. People are sensitive to the ways in which and have experiences in which white institutions have paraded Black trauma as a way to, again, prop up Black and Brown artists as a voice and as a way to connect to audiences that previously found these institutions irrelevant. And so to find a way to actually create those pathways in which the work like my own can still lead to critical conversations is a difficult, intricate process. And, you know, that goes well beyond me. What I will say, however, is that debate, that the debate is still necessary, and that this is the part of the way we hold institutions accountable, because the opposite is that they move away from this work and that they don't take any daring steps to hosting work that is ugly, that is hard.
Speaking of work that is hard, we are obviously in a moment of racial reckoning and a racial uprising for social justice that has taken hold of the country after the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and others. And as a result of those, we are seeing a number of public art installations, some, you know, with the backing of institutions, but many just people taking up their supplies and painting over plywood that has been covering the windows of many businesses for weeks, painting murals on the sides of walls in remembrance of the names of the people that have been killed by police violence. And we did a segment on the show this week sort of talking about how Black pain and Black mourning has changed in this moment. And I'm wondering what you would say to younger artists who are focusing on street art and art that's much more for the public consumption rather than working within institutions at this time. Is the goal still to be at the Whitney?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And I think it also intersects with the question of what to do with public monuments that are being torn down. I would say to younger artists that there are many ways to be an artist and that there are many ways to therefore create impact and have a ripple effect with your work. Some of that takes place within the institutional space because there is still leverage to be gained there. There's still exposure. There's still ways in which an institution can and should amplify our practices. But that's not the only way to be an artist. And actually, half of my practice is socially engaged work that lives far outside of the art, traditional art space realm. Works that are necessarily conducted in schools, housing developments, and everything in between. And so the question to me is not how we choose to have, or I should say, the question to me is, yes, continuing to choose how and what kind of relationship we have with institutions, but also to continue to return to what is necessary in the work. How do we connect to the communities that we are in service of? I never speak for anyone, but my work is always in service of BIPOC folks. And so I will take my work anywhere that I must in order for that connection to be enabled.
Sean, there have been a number of institutions, including some arts institutions, that have released statements reflecting their support for Black Lives Matter and racial justice. Have you seen any indication that any of the museums are actually taking actions to back up their statements?
I think it's too early to say or to see if these actions will become visible. But I will say that something feels different in this moment. Because of our voices and the visibility that we are, and I say we because I'm talking about art practitioners, art workers, those that have invested in these art institutions are calling out the behaviors and practices that have harmed us, that have been shaping the ways in which we work with these institutions for decades. What feels different now is that because of our airing out, museums have been forced to compete with one another. And so now we have very visible, documented statements as to what institutions will do. And that we didn't have before. We had our demands. But now we have the organizational voices saying what they're committing to. And that we can hold up to them in the near future.
This conversation has been a tough one. We've been talking a lot about pain and representation, but we're also asking people in this moment, and a lot of our guests, we've been asking them this question: is there something you're doing, Sean, in this moment that's so hard for so many people? It could be the smallest thing that's bringing you some joy these days.
Yeah, Tanzina, thank you. You know, this is what people and critics won't understand necessarily. You know, there are artists like myself that don't seclude themselves into the safety of their studio. We are deeply embedded and invested in the liberation, safety, and well-being of our communities. The work that I do in drawing is reflective of my practice in the justice system and beyond is reflective of the work that I do with my neighbors, with young Black and brown folks. We are part of this work. And this is going back to your art life equation. This is what we are made of. And so when there's pain and trauma in the streets, it's not just that we're reflecting that on a piece of paper, it's that we live it. And this is our work. It is our responsibility to interrogate what is happening in the streets, to interrogate how these images circulate in society, to interrogate the language that is projected onto our Black and brown bodies. And so the only way that I can really answer your question is to say that in all of the ugliness, in all of the mess, what sustains me are these moments of joy that I see in the lives and bodies of the people that I work with and for, because there will be so many derailments, so many losses along the way. It's the beautiful struggle, as Ta-Nehisi Coates describes. But in those losses, every single moment we are able to smile, every single moment that we are in a place where we feel we can live fully, acknowledging all the mess, not pushing it away, and still living fully, that's to me, that's what sustains me.
Sean Leonardo is an artist based in New York City. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tosina.
With more and more states reopening their economies, contact tracing is expected to play a critical role in slowing the spread of COVID-19. But tracking down people who have been exposed to the coronavirus, which is a key element of contact tracing, is proving to be a challenge. Crystal Watson is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And I asked her to remind us exactly how contact tracing works.
What happens is someone has a positive test for coronavirus. The public health department, a contact tracer, will get in touch with them, ask them how they're doing, ask what resources they need, if they need connection to healthcare, for example, and then also ask who they may have been around during the time that they have been infectious, which could be about 2 days before they develop symptoms up until the time that they isolated themselves. And so then the contact tracer will get in touch with those contacts. And by close contact, we mean within 6 feet for more than 15 minutes is the kind of the standard that's being used. And ask those close contacts to quarantine at home for 14 days. And if contacts do that and follow that guidance, and if they are indeed infected, then they won't be out in the community spreading the virus to others. And the chain of transmission ends with them.
Crystal, this sounds very efficient, or I don't know if it sounds efficient, but it definitely sounds like a way to prevent the spread. But it doesn't sound like something that's easy to do. Is that right?
Contact tracing, it is a pretty straightforward idea, but in practice, it's pretty difficult. So you have to get someone on the phone, have them answer the phone. And that's pretty difficult these days. I know I don't answer my phone when it's an unknown number most of the time because of all the spam calls that we get. So that's a tough ask even to get somebody to pick up.
Then after that, you're really looking for them to divulge information.
Yeah, so the contact tracer will ask questions about how they're doing, their health status, and then also if it's a case, to ask about their close contacts. And if it's a contact, ask about their activities and ask them to stay at home. And that's also a big ask to ask someone to quarantine for 14 days.
Are we using different kinds of contact tracing depending on which state we're talking about?
So the basics of contact tracing is pretty universal. There are also contact tracing digital tools that could be employed. They're not being employed widely in the U.S. yet, but they have been used in other parts of the world.
Remind us again, Crystal, who is implementing contact tracing here in the United States? Is it from the federal government? Are these state efforts or city efforts?
So right now, it's really a combination of state and local contact tracing efforts. So funding has come down from the federal government, as well as some guidance from the CDC to help with state and local contact tracing, but it's being done on the ground and led by state and local health departments.
I know in New York City and New York State, at the peak of the pandemic, our state and local officials were hiring many, many contact tracers. How do we know whether those efforts have been successful?
There are a number of ways to understand how effective contact tracing is. First of all, it's the number of contact tracers that have been hired. That's a pretty easy number to get at. But then we also want to know about effectiveness of the contact tracing itself. And so there are some indicators that show us how effective that is. And that could be the number of cases that are coming out of quarantine as opposed to from individuals who are not in quarantine. We want that number to be high because if cases arise from people in quarantine, we know they haven't been out in the community spreading it to others. Or the number of new cases that are linked to other known cases epidemiologically. And we also want that number to be high because then we can be more confident that there's not a large pool of unrecognized spread in our communities.
I want to talk a little bit about who has access to the information. So say that you're a contact tracer and you've located someone who'd been in contact with someone who's infected with the virus or has the virus. What do you do with that information?
The data is collected by contact tracers on individuals. That data is used to support those individuals and keep up with them, make sure they're doing okay in quarantine or isolation, connect them with resources, provide them with packages so they can stay at home. But it can also be aggregated up and de-identified and used for disease surveillance at a higher level. But ultimately, the information stays with public health. It's not transmitted to any other government agencies or any companies, and individuals should be confident that their identities will be protected. They won't be revealed to other people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about digital contact tracing, because we know that some folks that have cell phones had suddenly experienced updates to their phones that include some sort of coronavirus contact tracing application. What is the role of tech companies like Google and Apple? Have they been involved, and to what extent?
Yeah, in the US and actually around the world, Google and Apple have basically set a standard for digital contact tracing, and it's not even really digital contact tracing. They're calling it exposure notification. So this means that they have put together an approach on their platforms called an API, where public health agencies can develop applications to go on those platforms that will enable individuals who test positive to report that to the app and then also notify any potential contacts who have been in close contact with them during the time they've been infectious. And they use Bluetooth low energy as a way to do this and do this in a very privacy-preserving way.
Crystal, you said the magic word, privacy, and I think that no matter, Crystal, what you tell some folks, there is a hesitation for big government or big tech, frankly, to get their hands on such a personal piece of information. Are privacy concerns something that contact tracers are aware of and how they might affect their ability to collect data?
Contact tracers are very aware of privacy concerns. Contact tracing isn't something new for public health. They are very practiced at keeping this information private and safeguarding it, but they're also very aware of the public's concern around this. And so part of public health's responsibility is to provide messaging to the public to help them understand how their data is being protected.
And if you could give us a sense of a place that you think is doing it well, because we've been hearing mixed reports on the efficacy of contact tracing so far. I don't know if it's because this is a relatively new thing. I don't know if it's because folks, like we said earlier, may not be picking up the phone, or there just may be privacy concerns. But are there any places that you're seeing that are doing it well, and any places that you're seeing that are not doing it well?
We do have some great examples in the U.S., starting with Massachusetts. They were the first to really scale up their workforce, and they've achieved a lot of success. New York and New York City in particular, New York City just stood up its contact tracing effort at the beginning of June. And so we're just starting to see metrics come out of that. And I have to say that both of these locations are being very transparent in their metrics, which is really great because it helps other people learn about their programs and what they're doing well and what needs improvement. So some of the early data may be a little discouraging, but it's getting better.
I wanted to drill down a little bit more on populations that may be more hesitant to engage with contact tracing because of the current climate. You may have immigrants who have coronavirus who are afraid of any government intervention because it could affect their citizenship status. You have Black Americans in particular who have a history of surveillance in the United States and distrust of medical establishments. And then you have the elderly who may just not have the technology. So given those three limitations with those three populations, of course, not generalizing here, how do contact tracers sort of get past those barriers?
They do pose a challenge here, and these are very legitimate reasons that people may not want to engage. But I think one approach that public health is taking to overcome those barriers is really to hire contact tracers and train them from the communities that they want to protect. And so if you get on the phone with someone from your community who speaks your language, who understands your circumstance, I think people are much more likely to be trusting and to engage. And so that is one critical piece of contact tracing that I think every location should be mindful of.
And for those who are concerned about maintaining their privacy, is there anything that they should be mindful of, any protections that they can take to make sure that those concerns are alleviated?
Yeah, I think it's valid, first of all, to confirm the identity of the person who's on the phone. I know there have been some instances of fraud with contact tracing, so asking for verification of that identity is important. And then also, I think it's valid to ask your contact tracer what they are specifically doing to protect your information.
Crystal, where do we see contact tracing going as cases increase across the country?
The idea from the beginning of the pandemic, when we had these population level stay-at-home orders and other social distancing measures, was to flatten the curve and get cases down to a manageable level. That was the purpose of that. And then during that time, the idea was to build up testing and contact tracing capacity to be able to manage the pandemic in an ongoing way. Some locations have been able to do that, others have not. And so in places where we're seeing really large spikes in cases, contact tracing is still really critical. It should be a centerpiece of our response, but it may not be enough. It may be that we need to go back to flattening that curve again. And while that's really unfortunate, it really illustrates why we should be building up contact tracing capacity, both for now and for later in the fall. We may see additional spikes in cases as well as seasonal influenza.
Crystal Watson is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Crystal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And we'd love to hear from you. Has a contact tracer reached out to you, or are you yourself a contact tracer? Tell us about your experience by calling us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.